You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 21, Docile Surrender Monkey. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Kamikaze Expo, new guests being added to Star Trek Las Vegas 2012, Star Trek the Exhibition opening at the St. Louis Science Center, some of Star Trek's spookiest moments, and the state of Enterprise Profic. In the feature, we'll be joined by Brian Finifter of Down in Front and Bob Fresh of Dork Trek to discuss The Next Generation's second season. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fantastic. These Sundays are turning into days of intense geekery for me because I go to this gaming meetup and I've been playing the Star Trek deck building game, and it sort of gives me a chance to stretch my geek muscles. I remembered not only the plot line of the season one episode Justice, I remembered that it was episode 107, and I remembered
Wow, that's part of the card game.
No, it was just related to it. Any chance to show how much of a nerd I am. Apparently, I jump at the chance and I try to impress
the other
nerds.
Are you going to print a t-shirt that says Justice on the back and 107 on the front?
I might.
Like a baseball jersey?
Oh, we do. I keep meaning to mention, we need to make shirts for Trek FM. I was thinking one that was like Warp 8 with lots of question marks and exclamation marks. Longtime listeners of the show will remember why Warp 8 is such a crazy number.
But yes. I know. I mean, boy, you tell somebody you're going to Warp 8, and I mean, you're asking them to really go out on a limb for
indeed,
you there.
Indeed. Well, how is
the
your...
The looks that you get, wow.
How is your whatever day it is in Japan? Saturday? Sunday? Tuesday?
It's Monday afternoon right now. Yeah, it's been good. It's been a busy weekend. Of course, today's Halloween, and as you know, it's fairly common these days to decorate for Halloween in stores, but people typically don't decorate their houses. You see a few people might put a couple of things out, but nothing like in the States. And of course, kids do not trick or treat door to door either.
Oh, no.
But the local area, a kids group, had organized trick or treating for a group of 56 kids, and they asked three houses to be the designated stopping points for the trick or treating. And of course, we were one of those, being the American family in the neighborhood. So we had fun Saturday. We decorated. We have trees in front of our porch, and so we put orange lights in the trees, carved a jack-o'-lantern, put some other decorations out, and then the kids came by, and that was quite something because it wasn't, you know, three at a time, two at a time like in the States. It was 56. We had two big groups came by, so it was interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your various Star Trek-themed Halloween decorations. Did you have a big blow-up Dr. Pulaski? Data, what's the difference? Ooh.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't have to be Halloween for me to have that out. I keep that out all year round. But it is funny, you know, when people pass the little proximity sensor and it goes off and it spews that Pulaski wisdom. And also the Pulaski wit comes out
nice.
As well. So it makes for a very entertaining evening.
When the proximity alarm goes off, does Geordi do a barrel roll?
He does, actually. Yeah, I had to pay extra for that feature, but I think it's well worth it. Really completes the whole scene.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, you know, we'll talk a little bit later about some of Star Trek's spookiest moments in honor of Halloween. But before we do that, let's jump into some other Star Trek news. And there's an event coming up this coming weekend in Los Angeles that if you're a Star Trek fan and you're in the area, I think you'll be very interested in.
Yeah, really cool. They're doing the Kamikaze Expo in Los Angeles. It looks similar to Comic-Con, which is, of course, in San Diego. And then they just had the one in New York a couple weeks ago. And I have yet to have the chance to go to any of these. But this was the first ever Kamikaze. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, is this is the first one. But they have quite a slate of guests lined up. And As you said, it's more like Comic-Con in this, as opposed to a Star Trek convention, in the sense that it's a very large-scale convention covering all sorts of things, such as comics and video games, art, movies, television.
Right.
So it's not exclusively Star Trek. But on the Star Trek front, they do have about a dozen guests lined up, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. They don't have the biggest names, but they definitely have some pretty impressive ones. I mean, Robert Beltran is going to be there, of course, Chakotay. Jennifer Leanne, who is Kes. Chase Masterson, who played some of my favorite characters from DS9. Garrett Wang and Robert Picardo, John DeLancey. So, you know, if you go there, you're going to see these pretty big name Star Trek actors. And like you talked about, going to the smaller cons can sometimes be a better way to actually have a one-on-one interaction with some of these people. Like my friend who just met Jonathan Frakes a couple weeks ago. You know, you don't meet Jonathan Frakes by going to Las Vegas. That's going to only happen at one of these smaller... I mean, of course, Frakes isn't going to be at this one, but you know, if you really want to meet John DeLancey, this is going to be a great opportunity.
Yeah, right. Because even if this, as an overall expo, is very large scale, the Star Trek portion itself, because it's not exclusively a Star Trek convention, means that you'll have a better chance of actually getting to talk to these actors compared to, say, Star Trek Las Vegas, where there are just so many people there that it's harder to get in touch with them. Because, you know, I actually talked to John DeLancey many years ago in Tuscaloosa, because it was a very small, very local Star Trek convention.
Right.
There were probably only a few hundred people there. And so he had time to actually talk to people.
Yeah.
And it's always a great experience.
Yeah. And it's not going to be as expensive to find a hotel, or if you have friends in LA. You know, I hear stuff like, you know, to go to Comic-Con from anywhere other than San Diego, it's going to cost you, you know, $1,500 for the weekend. Whereas this is actually a pretty cheap con. It's $12 a day, $20 for both days. Hotels are very easy to find in LA. So, you know, if you're anywhere nearby, I'm up in Seattle, so it'd be a bit of a flight or a drive for me. And it's a bit short notice now that I'm just finding out about it. But, you know, for, you know, years in the future, this is not bad if you're on the East Coast or you're on the West Coast and you're looking for just more of a low-key kind of comic convention.
Yeah, most definitely. So this is going to be taking place it's coming up, I think it kicks off on Saturday, November 5th.
5th and 6th,
Saturday
right.
and 6th. So this weekend,
right.
Saturday and Sunday. And it's going to be taking place at the LA Convention Center. And also another nice thing that the Kamikaze Expo is doing is they're giving a percentage of all the proceeds to charity.
Yeah.
And those include the Amazon Foundation and also Gamers United. So, and they help children in local hospitals. So not only do you have a chance to meet some of your favorite Star Trek actors, but also you have a chance to contribute to some great charities as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm hoping I can get a friend of the show, Brian Affinifter, who's going to be joining us later. I'm hoping I can get him to at least drop in and give us a sense of the convention. But if any of our listeners are in the LA area, please, please go take pictures, give us reports back, let us know how it was. If you have a chance encounter with someone like Garrett Wang, tell us if his hair is still really long and if that's still kind of weird.
Well, if you want to know more about this, of course, we'll have a link in the show notes, and you can also visit kamikazeexpo.com, and you can follow username kamikazeexpo on Twitter. And it's a slightly different spelling because it's a play on the word comics. That's C-O-M-I-K-A-Z-E, Expo.
Right.
Okay. Well, while we're talking about conventions, Greg, of course, it hasn't been that long since Star Trek Las Vegas wrapped for this year, but all eyes are already on next year's event. And we talked on an earlier show here a week or two ago about some of the names that were lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And now Creation has news of more names.
Yeah, it looks like Marina Sirtis and John Billingsley are both going to be in attendance. Obviously, big Star Trek fans will know Marina Sirtis was Troy. And most will know that Billingsley played Dr. Phlox on Enterprise, especially the contingent of our listeners who are diehard Enterprise fans.
That's right.
They're pretty good names to add to the list. I mean, you already had William Shatner, Kate Mulgrew, John DeLancey again, Brent Spiner, Michael Dorn. You know, Patrick Stewart's probably going to be there. These sort of big names they've already announced. So good to just add some more names to this list. It's going to be quite a convention.
Yeah, it is. I think that, well, first of all, I know we have a couple of listeners and followers on Twitter who are probably right now dialing the phone if they haven't already. to make their travel arrangements to go see Marina. But I think by the time, you know, everything shapes up, that the majority of the cast from The Next Generation, especially, will be there, and probably DS9 and Voyager as well. They always seem to come out. Avery Brooks doesn't get out to conventions as much as the others, but most people are there. And hopefully more Enterprise actors will come out as well. I guess it was a pretty good showing this past time.
Yeah.
Right, with the Enterprise actors.
I think Enterprise is, you know, you talked last week with Larry Nemechek about the pendulum swinging towards Next Gen, but I think the pendulum is swinging away from hatred for Enterprise. As people realize, people are starting to realize, I think, that there's no Star Trek on the air. And they kind of missed this show. You know, either they didn't watch it when it was on, or they watched a little bit of it and then just said, oh, well, this is rubbish, I'm going to move on. And now there's a lot more openness when I talk to people about it. You know, even if they've never seen the show, when I tell them, you know, you should go back and watch Enterprise, you know, people don't just scoff at me. They say, you know, maybe I will. Maybe I will check out that Netflix, you know, check out Enterprise on Netflix and see if it maybe is more Star Trek than I remembered. And so I...
Because it's Star Trek they haven't seen yet in a lot of cases. And so now that there has been no new Star Trek for so long, except for the JJ movie, maybe they're more inclined to go back and watch it. And it's a little bit, you know, time... That time gap between when it was on television and people thought that it was ruining Star Trek and now it's kind of maybe made it a little bit more easier to take for people like
that. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I don't know that time is going to do that much good for Star Trek 5, Star Trek 9, Star Trek 10.
Well, but it's had 23 years and it's still looked upon as maybe not the best.
But Enterprise, I really think it ages well. Like when you can see it outside of it being the only Trek on TV, when you can see it outside of missing those characters from Next Gen and even Voyager and DS9.
I think it's also when you reach the point where you feel like you want to go in and fill in some of those gaps, then maybe you're a little more open to it.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, hopefully we can see some more of those actors there, because those are some great guys. Anthony Montgomery, now I'm going to blank just like Stuart Baird on the names of the other guys, but really fantastic actors and great people. So hopefully they'll be at Las Vegas as well. Really looking forward to this convention. Although, as we talked about with Kamikaze being kind of inexpensive, Las Vegas does not come without a pretty penny being spent.
That's right. They've already put the gold packages on sale on the Creation website for Las Vegas 2012. And those are running for $699 right now.
Wow.
So it's a pretty penny. Of course, that's for the gold package. There will be less expensive options for you to get in. But still, even the least expensive options are considerably more than the smaller conventions from around the country.
Unfortunately, you do need the gold package in order to have breakfast with the Glommer.
That's right. And you have to go beyond gold and get the Latinum package if you also want to have your photo taken with the Glommer.
Ah, the Platinum package. I'm going to need to sell a lot of Gold Plus Latinum for that.
Yeah, I hope you are saving up your money there, Greg, because I know that anything short of a photo of you in the Glommer will mean that Las Vegas 2012 was just not quite fully satisfying.
It will not suffice. It will not suffice.
All right. Well, if you're on the other side of the country and you want to take in some Star Trek... not actors, but props, models, costumes, and all sorts of things like that from the series, then you'll be happy to know that Star Trek the Exhibition is making its way to Missouri to the St. Louis Science Center after a stay at the Kennedy Space Center.
Yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago, and we did promise to keep people apprised of the exhibition's movements around the country. And yeah, I have not been to the St. Louis Science Center ever, but I'm sure it's similar to that in Kennedy Space Center, similar to the one I grew up with in Charlotte. And wow, this will just be, you know, 12,000 square feet of Star Trek that you can actually look at and be in and touch is just astonishing. You know, I've been reading Steve Jobs biography this week. And it talked about how Jobs needed to pick up and hold the various prototypes. And he'd just go down to the prototype room and pick them up and look at them and turn them around just to get a sense for them. Because it's so different when you see it on a TV screen from when you're actually holding it in your hand. And that's just what I'd love to see. You know, I want to see what a phaser actually feels like.
Yeah, most definitely. Of course, it would be a phaser prop.
Sure, sure.
Hey, Greg, you realize that Star Trek is a TV show, right?
Are you sure that I can't vaporize someone's chorus?
Yeah. I mean, glommers are real, but some of these other things are
okay.
Not fully operational.
As long as glommers are real.
So, yeah, it is amazing, 12,000 square feet. That's something that this particular stop for Star Trek the Exhibition at the St. Louis Science Center is going to bring to fans that the others so far have not, which is having the full collection on display at one time, because it's such a huge collection that most of these places, like when it was at the Louisville Science Center in Kentucky, when it was at the Kennedy Space Center, they weren't able to actually display everything at once. Mm-hmm. And finally, in the Boeing Hall, which is a new addition to the Science Center in St. Louis, thanks to the capacity of that hall, they're going to have the full exhibition on display.
Yeah, that's going to be really impressive. I mean, they're going to have engineering, sick bay, Quark's bar, the bridge of the original, 1701. They say you can actually sit in Kirk's chair. You know, hopefully Zachary Quinto won't be there to tell you to get out of the chair, and you can just sort of sit there and bask in the glory.
You'll be like Sulu, who gets so excited if he has a chance to sit in that chair, right?
Oh my God, I'm in the chair. I can give commands. Oh crap, Kirk is back.
That's right. One day I'm going to have my own command.
Sorry, Chekhov.
All right.
You're never getting your own command. Sulu, yes. Everyone else on the ship, yes. Chekhov, no.
No, not till you do something about that hair. All right, we'll talk about that a little more in a bit, too. all right, well, this is going to be a long stay. It opens this Friday. Actually, it's already opened. It opened last Friday, October 28th. And it's going to be running for 7 months, all the way through May 28th of 2012. So a lot of time for you to make your way over to St. Louis if you live anywhere in the general vicinity and you can schedule a weekend for a road trip.
Mm-hmm.
Very great way to spend it.
Yeah, definitely. I can't wait until this comes to Seattle. I'm sure it will. I'm simply sitting and waiting, and once it does, I certainly will report back.
Well, I can't wait till it comes to Tokyo, and I'm pretty sure it won't, but...
A nerd can dream.
I can always hope. That's right. Yeah. So we'll put some information about this on our website as well, on the show notes page for this episode, and... the ticket pricing here, it's two-tiered. If you're a member of the Science Center, you get discounted tickets, $875 for adults, $775 for seniors, and $675 for children ages 5 to 12. And if you're not a member, those tickets are roughly double. That's right. $1,750 for adults, going down to $1,350 for children. And you can go to the Science Center website, is slsc.org. And they have a new site coming up called boldlygoexplore.org, which is going to be devoted to Star Trek the Exhibition.
Nice.
And you can get more info there as well.
Very cool.
All right. So, Greg, you already asked me earlier about my Pulaski prop and my Geordi barrel roll. And Halloween, well, it's Halloween right now here as we record this, and we had our festivities over the weekend. Mm-hmm. So it's a perfect time to ask you about some of Star Trek's spookiest moments. If someone wants to go and enjoy some Halloween-themed or just kind of spooky Star Trek, where should they turn, apart from the obvious, of course?
Well, this can bring up one of the more disturbing memories from my childhood. As I have mentioned on the show, I grew up with TNG. And sometimes being a, 5 or 6 year old watching TNG was not the best idea. Maybe you can help me remember this episode. All I remember was getting a recurring nightmare because of TNG. They were aliens with scissors, like gigantic scissors that just went snip, snip, snip. And it was terrifying. What episode was that, Chris?
I'm pretty sure it's Schisms, where the crew was being abducted and having medical experiments performed on them, and then repaired and then returned to their quarters. They would wake up feeling exhausted, and then sometimes they would have reactions to environments or objects where it was like they're having a traumatic memory.
Right.
And it took them a while to figure out what was going on, but they were actually being abducted by aliens from, like, I think they said deep within subspace or
wow,
some place like that, you know, that normally should not have a connection to our universe.
Right.
Yeah, very, very
it was
scary episode.
Crazy. And, you know, I don't remember the resolution. You know, all I remember was this recurring nightmare that I guess the crew was having. And so it was portrayed as that way on the show. And then for me, you know, nights on end, it was weeks before I was able to shake this episode. It was really, really creepy. And it actually aired. It was almost a Halloween episode. It aired on the 19th of October in 1992. Yes, I would have been, six years old at this point, and it was coming up on Halloween, and I don't know if it was intended to be that way, but it had this really deep effect on me. Can't wait to go see it again, you know, with more adult memory. I'm sure I've seen it, you know, but I haven't seen it recently. I don't know that
but
I want
you
to.
You have these memories of it.
I have this intense memory.
That's a very frightening episode for a six-year-old to see, and... You know, it's one of those, when Brandon Braga came on and was really starting to write for Next Generation, in those later seasons there, like season 5, 6 onwards, there were some very dark stories, some very like twisted psychological stories there, which typically came from Brandon Braga. That's one. Another is Frame of Mind, which I think came very soon after that, may have been the next episode, but soon after, where Riker... is in a play, and Riker, he's in a mental asylum, and suddenly that mental asylum becomes like real for him, and then you kind of lose track of what's real and what's not real. It's just like very twisted psychological thriller, which is another of the nice Halloween themed or horror themed episodes of The Next Generation.
Yeah, I'm looking up that one as well. Wow, I think it might be that when I just watch these episodes in syndication, I would just not watch these. Like, because maybe they just affected me as much when I was a kid, that it would start off and, you know, there's this image of Riker just, you know, screaming. And I think I would just turn it off. Like, I'm not going to deal with this.
Well, if you were a kid, yeah, probably so. You know, I mean, at least I was in university when these episodes were airing. So I had a different take on them, I'm sure. But yeah, as a kid, that would be pretty scary.
But like the ones from Voyager that this list mentioned, something like The Haunting of Deck 12, that was sort of set up as a ghost story. And I don't think it was as scary just because it...
No.
Because of the setup, because of the way it was done. I don't think Voyager was as... And maybe because Braga wasn't as interested in doing this in Voyager, but they weren't as interested in really creeping out the viewers. They were just more interested in telling a fun ghost story with that one.
Yeah, that's The Haunting of Deck 12. Mm-hmm. And I forget exactly the reason now, but the Voyager passed through a nebula. Something happened. They had to power down the ship. Mm-hmm. Basically, they had to shut off all the systems. And this was at the point where they have those four Borg children on the ship. Mm-hmm. They had them on there for like most of a season. And those children don't really know what's happening, and their alcoves get shut down. So they wake up, and Neelix greets them, and he has like a plasma torch, and then he takes and they sit around the plasma torch. It's kind of like Cub Scouts in the woods sitting around a campfire, and Neelix tells them ghost stories.
Yeah, and supposedly so the story he tells is not true, but I think the underlying thing is that the story was true, and that he was simply trying to not freak the kids out too much.
Yeah. So that's a good one from Voyager. There's also The Darkling from Voyager, where the doctor kind of becomes psychotic, basically.
Right. That one was creepy. I don't know if it quite reached the levels of TNG either, though.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not to the point of like schisms or Frame of Mind, especially.
The one from Voyager, The Thaw, was the one with...
Yeah,
what was his name from Kids in the Hall?
Michael McKeon.
Right.
Yeah. And, well, see, you know him from Kids in the Hall, whereas I know him from Laverne and Shirley.
Okay.
So...
Well, nevertheless. Michael McKean. I think he was on Kids in the Hall. He at least was in Spinal Tap, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and he was on Saturday Night Live around the time that The Thaw was shot, I think. Yeah.
So that is an episode that you either have to find goofy and funny, or, it's really going to creep you out. Because it was just
I never found it.
It was not right. It just did not feel good.
Yeah, it didn't feel good. It's actually on my list of one of the best episodes of Voyager.
Oh, really? Wow.
But you have to, you know, the premise of the Thaw is that why are we afraid of things and what is fear and how fear can paralyze you.
Right.
And Michael McKeon's character, this clown in the Thaw, is the personification of fear. And there are two people in that story who were literally scared to death. They were killed by being scared of extreme fear. And they, of course, they ultimately defeat him by overcoming their fear, right? I mean, if you're not afraid of him, he cannot exist because he's fear. But the way that the clown is played by Michael McKean, it was a really brilliant performance, in fact, from an unlikely source, because you know him from comedy,
right.
primarily, Michael McKean, at least up to that point.
And we're gonna talk about Joe Piscopo coming up, playing a comedic role as a comedian. And maybe that maybe that doesn't work quite as well. We'll get to that. But Michael McKean playing
If Joe Piscopo had been the clown here, I don't know if it would have worked so well.
It's very possible.
But so what is it? What are you afraid of?
He's doing his Jerry Lewis impression.
We always have to do impressions on the Ready Room, and they're usually not very good, but we try. So this is a very creepy, twisted episode, though, of Voyager. Probably more so than any episode of Voyager. Yeah. Very good episode, though, if you haven't seen it. Or if you saw it a long time ago and all you kind of remember is that, oh, there was a clown.
Yeah.
Go back and watch it and keep in mind that the story is about how fear can paralyze you and how do you overcome that fear. It's a very good story.
Yeah, you on your surface, on the surface, you want to think of it as an episode like Move Along Home, but it's nothing like that.
No, it's nothing like that.
It feels like it might be, but it's really, it's this whole other crazy thing. It, you know, and the clown performance is sort of invokes memories of the Joker from The Dark Knight in this. It's a clown, but it's also really creepy and twisted. And so that's probably my favorite from this list. What about you?
Well, of course, you have to go back to the classic, probably the only true Halloween episode of Star Trek, which was Cat's Paw from the original series. You know, the most at the end of Cat's Paw, we find out that the Fraggles were actually responsible for everything that was going on. So that's a little bit of a letdown at the end for those of you who are old enough to remember Fraggle Rock. I think Greg's drawing a blank on me.
I do know what you're referring to. I don't know if I reached Cat's Paw was one of those episodes that I sort of get into and don't make it to the end.
That's the at the very end they come out. Of course, the most frightening thing. I mean, you have witches, you have a warlock, you have skeletons, you have. You have enough smoke pouring out everywhere for an Adam Lambert concert. And yet, despite all this, O'Kirk, Spock, and McCoy get thrown in a dungeon with skeletons.
Yep.
But nevertheless, the most frightening thing in this episode is Chekhov's hair. And that's something that we have to remember.
Right.
And hey, it was Halloween. He was going as a monkey. So what can you say? There are some other episodes. We won't go through everything on the list. I put together this list because I'm putting together an article that I'm going to post on Trek FM. So if you want to go and read that, I did a little write-up for some episodes. I didn't include every single possible episode that has a Halloween or spooky theme to it, but I picked out, I think about 14 of them here. Yeah. If we just jump ahead for, our Enterprise fans, there are a few. The first one that I always think of is Fight or Flight, which is, I want to say, the third episode of the series. It's one of the first few episodes. And that one, they encounter a ship where there are just these corpses hanging upside down that have been drained, like some kind of fluid drained through them. It was just really eerie, creepy kind of thing, which I guess we got that on Enterprise because of the time period that the show was made in, you know, in the 2000s. Right. We wouldn't have gotten anything like that on The Next Generation, for example.
Oh, certainly.
That wouldn't have been on TV at that time.
It's memory. It reminds me of, I believe it was Bushwhacked from Firefly, where they sort of happen upon another ship that was sort of crew members are all dead, and it's just very creepy. So this is sort of episode, you know, I don't love because I'm not a big fan of scary things. You know, I don't watch scary movies, but it's very well done. And I do like how it grew Hoshi's character, you know, that early in the show.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, they're already jumping in and saying, you know, Hoshi's this sort of person and she's going to approach this situation this way and she's going to grow as a character. You know, TNG wasn't doing that, you know, that early on. It really shows to me that the Enterprise writers had a grasp on these characters, you know, that early.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one thing that I take away from that episode is that it's not so much that the episode itself is that memorable, but the fact that it shows very well right off the bat the kind of reaction that this crew has to the unknown. You know, they're the first crew, they're the first humans to really venture out this far and experience these things, at least on behalf of the Earth government at that time. And yeah, the reaction to it, it's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
If we go ahead forward, there are a few, you know, there's Dead Stop where they find this kind of haunted space station.
That was the one I mentioned Impulse. A few weeks ago was my trivia question for you, because it was
That's right.
The episode with Roxanne Dawson, not only directing, but also doing the computer voice. I love this episode.
Right.
I don't know that I remember Impulse. That was the one with the crazy Vulcans, right? Who were being affected by
Impulse.
The Trillium or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
Stuff.
It's zombie Vulcans.
Right.
So
Trillium.
If you love zombies, Trillium, yeah. If you love zombies and you love Vulcans, then Impulse is the episode for you.
Oh, goodness.
Because the zombie Vulcans are on their way to get you.
Yeah.
All right. So those are a few, you know, spooky moments from Star Trek. And we'll have a link to the article I'm writing in the show notes here. If this gets out, this show gets out probably late on Halloween. You can always make a note for next year if you haven't found my article, which will already be up for Halloween. And grab some marshmallows, sit around the fire, roast them, tell ghost stories, and enjoy some Trek.
Fantastic.
All right. So, one more story today, Greg, before we wrap up here. There are a couple of angles here to this. Originally, when I put this in the notes, I was just going to talk about the new Star Trek Enterprise book that's out called The Romulan War to Brave the Storm. And I don't so much want to talk about the book itself at this point because I haven't read it. What I wanted to talk about was the concept of the Romulan War itself and how we missed out on that on the television series, and yet they're revisiting it in the novels.
Yeah, you might call this Manicotto's Bag of Hindsight, the book series.
The book series, yeah. But since that, just over the last 24 hours, there's also been a lot of talk about concern from Enterprise fans that the Profic, the Enterprise book series, may be discontinued soon. I mean, we haven't received word from that, but there's a lot of concern about it because this book is the second book in the Romulan War series, which would make you think that there was probably another one 4 or 5 months ago. Mm-hmm. But actually, the first book was published in October of 2009. And here we are, the end of October of 2011, and we're just now getting part two. And there just doesn't seem to be much activity going on in terms of publishing the continuation novels for Enterprise.
That is disappointing. And it's being released right off the bat as a mass market paperback, you know, at $7.99. So, I mean, but you got to imagine the audience for this book is going to be pretty slim. You know, even if everyone of our, you know, rabid Enterprise fan base rushes out and buys it on day one, that's still not that many people buying the book.
Yeah, that's true. They have so many series going. What I've noticed over the past few years is going back to, I want to say even into 2008, but as they were leading up to the JJ movie and then during the year following the JJ movie, they were really focusing on the original series almost all the time. And I think for quite a while, for much of a year, there was nothing else published that was not original series.
Yeah.
And now they're publishing some next generation stuff again. They've got the Typhon Pact. They've got Vanguard going again. I want to say there was a new Frontier book from Peter David out not too long ago. But it seems that the overall publication frequency of Star Trek novels does seem to be dropping. And it's a little bit of a concern because that's, for right now anyway, how Star Trek stays alive for us fans.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's disappointing on one level, but you also got to realize, I guess, that, you know, Star Trek as a franchise is sort of moving on. You talked with Larry about the pendulum swing. So I could see next-gen novels being published, but then what do you really do? I mean, I guess the Titan novels are going strong. Is that a bad assumption to make?
Yeah. I don't know if I would call it strong. You know, they come out every now and then, but, you know, it's not like it would have been back in the golden age,
right. You
know, say the late 90s, where with a series like that, you would have had a new novel every 6 months,
right. Probably. Wow.
It's, yeah, not like that anymore. I mean,
you know, you just imagine Star Trek is diminishing as far as, you know, new stuff. You know, the fandom for the old stuff is going strong. The new movie is probably going to be really big. But as far as people wanting more of this stuff, I'm not sure they are. And along with that, the publishing industry as a whole is sort of shrinking. People aren't reading like they used to.
Yeah.
You know, unless they come out with Star Trek, you know, vampire, Romulan, werewolves, you're just not going to bring in the crowds.
Are you talking about the USS Hogwarts under the command of Captain Harry Twilight?
Captain Bella Swan of the USS Sparkly.
Okay. Oh, wow. Gosh. I think you just hit goal. Quick, let's go register that domain right now.
I think we've
before anybody else does. All right. All right. Well,
it's sad,
yeah,
but
I see
on
your
one
point.
Level, inevitable, you know.
Yeah, I see your point. I think the audience for it is still enough that we should see more frequent publication, personally. You know, we see so much activity in comics. I think that there's a smaller market for comics than there are for novels. And yet we see all this activity in the comics, and yet we have a red flag going up in the novel series with concern about that. But
yeah,
we'll see where it heads. You know, I mean, these things do go in cycles as well. So one day things will pick back up, I think.
Yeah.
So just in terms of this particular novel, anyway, The Romulan War to Brave the Storm, if you are interested in The Romulan War, which I think a lot of even non-Enterprise fans are, because it is that bit of lore between the original series and the Next Generation. Well, it's actually not between. It's prior to the original series that we hoped that we would have seen on Enterprise and kind of got chipped out of by the show being canceled early. This book, written by Michael A. Martin, will help you fill in the gaps there a bit. It tells the story of how the Romulan Star Empire feels threatened by Earth and this coalition of planets, which Earth is part of, which I believe would be Andor and Tellar and Vulcan and Earth, kind of the precursor to the Federation. How the Romulans feel threatened, how they plan to strike at Earth, which they see as the heart of the problem, and then tell the story of the Romulan War. So even though we didn't get to see it on Enterprise, and we probably will never get to see it in a movie, as we've discussed before, it would make a very cool movie, you can at least kind of fill in the gaps a little bit through this book.
I mean, I think this is the part of the Enterprise era, the Enterprise mythology, that all fans would have gotten behind and wanted to see. You know, I saw a joke somewhere about one of the scariest parts of Star Trek being the season 3 of Enterprise. And, you know, that's a little unfair, but season three, you know, the Zindi arc, that's not what people want to see.
Oh, I saw that it's too. Just, yeah. Yeah.
A little unfair. But, you know, if season three had been the Romulan War, I think every single TOS fan, every single Next Gen fan, new people would have come in to see it because that was, you know, that's what fans wanted to see. You know, let's actually see history being made.
You know, yeah, season-long arc like they did with the Zindi, mm-hmm. but the arc is the Romulan War. Yeah, yeah, you would have had every TOS fan would have been tuned in every week.
Yeah, you know, even if they had to jump the show forward 10 years in order to make it happen, there's no reason not to do that. You know, start season three with the refurbished Enterprise. Have the Coalition of Planets already exist. Have the Romulans attack Earth. No, I don't know why they didn't do it. You know, obviously it's, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, but it's what they had. You know, it was on the timeline.
They weren't to that point in the timeline yet, but they could have been if they had handled the first season and the second season differently.
Exactly, yeah.
For sure. On a previous show, we talked about the start of the Next Generation and how, as the show went on into season three, they grew the beard and the show got better. And today, we're going to talk a bit about the second season of the Next Generation and how the show progressed from its premiere. And with us today, we have two guests. We have friend of the show, Brian Finifter. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi, guys. Good.
Welcome, welcome.
Great. And also special guest from the Dork Trek podcast at dorktrek.com.
That's right.
Bob Fresh.
That's right. Hello, everyone. No, my actual name for Dork Trek is I'm Lieutenant Commander Bob Fresh of the USS Boner. We got to make sure we get it all out there.
Got to get that in there.
All right.
All right. It's great to have you with us.
The honorifics are very important.
Very important.
Okay. Well, so Next Generation, you know, the first season was, I know it was kind of a mixed bag. There was a lot of very obvious imitation of the original series, plus trying to be, hey, we're not the original series. We have men wearing dresses and things like that going on. And so, Bob, on Dork Trek, you guys started a while back with Encounter at Farpoint, and you're watching the whole series in order.
Yes.
And why don't you kick us off here with, you finished the first season, so now you guys are what, maybe 5-6 episodes into the second season?
The last episode we reviewed, which will be out, I guess, in a week or two, is on Natural Selection. And that is, I think, like the eighth episode of season two. So, I mean,
what are your impressions of season two? You know, coming off the break from season one, they had a few months. I think as Greg has mentioned before we started the show, they got more money for season two.
Mm-hmm.
Did that translate to anything for you?
They spent that money wisely because they built 10 forward. You know, like that's what they did with their budget increase.
And they hired Whoopi Goldberg, right?
Which is also pretty cool. I mean, the first episode of season two is the baby. And that's where, I guess, the alien entity comes in and impregnates Troy because he wants to see what it's like to be a human. And the episode's pretty goofy, but they do introduce some really cool kind of lasting effects to the series, being Guinan and 10 Forward. And I mean, without Guinan and 10 Forward, where would the series be as a whole? So you have to look at it like that. And sometimes you have to take the good with the bad. And I look at Guinan and 10 Forward as a positive addition to the series.
Yeah. What's crazy is that Troy never had much to do as counselor on the ship, but they sort of kept her on and then brought on Guinan, who then sort of did what Troy was supposed to be doing. But then they got rid of Beverly, who, sure, she wasn't the most effective doctor in some episodes where people would get shot and she had no idea what to do. She wasn't the most effective doctor, but she was a pretty good character and always had interesting things to do and had this interesting dynamic with Picard. She was gone, but Troy was there. And then there was this character of Guinan who sort of overlapped what she was supposed to be doing.
If I remember right, I think the child is the last of the scripts that was kind of, you know, in the beginning, they sort of pulled from the pile of, you know, because they made Star Trek, and it got canceled, and then they were going to make Star Trek Phase 2, which never actually ended up becoming a TV show and sort of got turned into the first movie. But when they started making Next Generation, they still kind of had this pile of scripts and ideas from Phase 2. And so a few of the first season episodes are kind of based off of, you know, kind of adapted from that pile. And if I remember right, the child is the last one of those scripts where they, you know, they explicitly pulled that idea from that pile.
I think there was one later with The Devil's Due, which comes up a few seasons later. I think it was a Phase 2 script.
Oh, really?
As well. But that's kind of
The Devil's Due is
then,
several. Yeah, that's several seasons later.
But up
later.
Here
that's
in the beginning, five, yeah, they had quite a few of those.
Yeah. So I definitely think Season 2 is Next Generation starting the process of figuring out what kind of show it is and how it's going to be different than the Star Trek that's come before it. And very explicitly not just recycling what Star Trek has done before, sometimes in a very straightforward way, like with The Naked Now or a couple of the other. Although Unnatural Selection is very, very reminiscent of The Deadly Years. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's the exact same problem. It might be even the same disease. I'm not sure. But but it's the beginning of the process of Next Generation ceasing to be simply trying to recycle what Star Trek had already done up to that point.
Well, I think the best example of that is an episode that I remember Dork Trek didn't like that much, but an episode I really loved, Elementary Dear Data, which really explored the concept of the holodeck and what it really would mean for these guys who, you know, you're spending months out there on the frontier, nothing better to do than go to the holodeck and just hang out. And it really got into some interesting things about not only is Data human, but what are these holodeck beings? You know, are they sentient? Could they be more than just holodeck beings? It's, you know, set the stage for the Doctor on Voyager, really did a lot of the stuff that the first season never bothered to do with the holodeck.
See,
I like Elementary Dear Data a bit, and I think it's probably the single holodeck malfunction episode that the malfunction I can actually get behind, because it's not the ship passed through a neutrino cloud and fried the circuits or whatever. You know, it's a perfect example of what always ends up happening with computers is you tell the computer to do something, and you yourself don't realize what you're asking the computer to do, and it does literally exactly what you're asking it to do, and that causes, and that, you know, that's the source of the drama and the conflict is, you know, you is user error as you know it's called. It's that I like that. That's like the single justification of basing real conflict around the holodeck that I think works in probably the entirety of the Star Trek franchise.
What was your take on this episode, Bob?
See, I always look at the holodeck episodes as mainly just kind of filler. Like, it's just silly and kind of goofy. Like, they don't know what to do, so they're just going to put a bunch of people in a computer machine and let them run around in costumes. But there was just such glaring problems with the episode because of the fact that when Data leaves the holodeck with the drawing of the paper... I mean, that means that things can leave the holodeck, and that goes exactly against Season 1, where Cyrus Redblock, as soon as he steps out, disappears. So, for all intents and purposes, Moriarty could have left the holodeck, and I guess Roddenberry, I guess Picard lied to, I guess in the original script, Picard lies to Moriarty and says, yeah, you can't leave. But then Roddenberry stepped in and was like, no, we can't have him do that because it kind of cheapens his character.
But you get things like in the first season, you have cases like where they're dripping with water from the holodeck and they come out in the corridor and water. So there's a lot of discrepancies.
I mean, I think
like
the technical explanation is that the holodeck just flat out replicates some things. It doesn't do it for everything. It obviously can't just replicate a whole human being.
Yeah, but it's tough. But
if it's just talking about water or paper, then I mean, it's a bullshit technicality kind of retcon sort of thing. But you know, I mean, I can buy that that's how that piece of technology would
yeah,
work
see,
if
yeah,
it
I
really
don't,
existed.
But the thing is, when you have a dude who wants to leave the holodeck and things that he creates leaves the holodeck, but he can't, it's just kind of get your facts straight, I guess, to some extent. And if Roddenberry's yeah. going to come in, yeah. if Roddenberry's going to come in and say, hey, this can't be this way, then at the end of the episode, when Moriarty disappears, you need to have a shot where the piece of paper disappears as well. Because now you just have some right. random piece of paper with a turtle drawn, as Moriarty called it, floating around the Enterprise. So that's it's just little kind of technical aspects like yeah. that. And I hate to get super nitpicky because I'm not that kind of guy, but, you know, I mean, if the whole episode's about this guy wanting to leave the holodeck, then, you know, you kind of need to tie up your loose ends to some extent.
Well, but on the bigger picture, you know, you've got Brent Spiner doing, you know, fantastic work, throwing himself into this Data as Holmes role. You even have LeVar Burton finally getting out of his shell, doing something more than just tell the captain what's going on with the engines. You have him, you know, sure, it's a bad English accent, but he's doing this sidekicky thing with Data that's really fun.
And that's the kind of stuff really that Argyle never did. So.
Exactly.
That's because, to be fair, Argyle was kind of hungover. I mean,
the whole time he's just loitering in the back of the scene all the time, right?
He was selling plasma for money.
Think we could vent plasma probably to fix this? I don't know.
He's like he's like Tony Shalhoub in Galaxy Quest. Like, this could work maybe. It's worth a shot.
Hey, you got $5?
Group hug, guys. Group hug.
I do think here, though, early on with this episode with Elementary Dear Data, they did, or as Pulaski would call it, Elementary Dear Data.
What's the difference?
Yeah.
So, one's my name, one is not.
Which is a great moment. I love that moment.
Dude, and that's the reason why I love Pulaski, because she's the fly in the ointment. Everyone gets along well. Everyone is happy-go-lucky on this vessel, everything's going well, and then you've got this crotchety old broad that just comes in and she's like, he's a robot and you're stupid. You know what I mean? There was a later scene
where she's on the bridge and Data's standing right there and she just talks about Data in the third person like he's not even there.
I know, it's like, awesome.
He's going. So, well, what I think they did do with this episode, though, is that they really, for possibly the first time, really established the holodeck as a key part of storytelling on The Next Generation, mm-hmm. which really kind of became one of the identities for that series that set it apart from the original series and gave it its right. flavor. And you had more of this references to literature. And in the original series movies, you have a lot of Shakespearean references and things that go on. But The Next Generation as a series made a lot more references to literature and to Shakespeare and so forth than the original series did during its run. Yeah. This kind of established that.
There are a few references in the original series. There's what's the one where with Kirk as a kid was on the colony and was it Kodos the executioner? Yeah. And then they visit this planet and the guy that's in the play is in the Shakespeare yeah. play. Mm-hmm. And the title of the episode is a line from Shakespeare, but I'm blanking on it right now, but
yeah, that's the conscience of the king.
Of the king, there you go, in which I'll catch the play is the thing in which I'll catch the conscience of the thing. But I like the problem is that in its worst moments, Next Generation uses the holodeck as a crutch. Mm-hmm. Whereas in its better moments, it's just using it to add texture to this world of like, okay, these people are kind of stuck out in space for months or years at a time, and they're going to get bored as anybody would, looking at the same hallways, the same beige carpets over and over again. So let's go live in Sherlock Holmes world for a while. Let's go live on, in Tempest world for a while, or do this or do that. So when they're using it to add texture, like the episode where Data is doing A Christmas Carol, yeah. or where he's doing The Tempest, the beginning of The Tempest, and the play mm-hmm. just kind of opens at The Tempest. It's like, okay, that's great. Just using it as texture, like, here's these people's lives before the episode starts. We're just going to catch a piece of that, and then we're going to go on to the episode. That's great. And I think this Elementary, My Dear Data is more this, more that than it is, right, you know, yeah. The circuits have been crossed. Now they're trapped and the holodeck bullets are real for some reason, even though they
should. This is another case where, this is another case where they are able to refer back to something where the original series was very episodic. Here, you know, later on in the series, they refer back to this episode and have a very good episode in Ship in the Bottle.
Oh, yeah. That one's great.
Yeah. Which I'm just looking at Memory Alpha right now, and apparently
cheater, you're a cheater.
It's not cheating. They say it says on here that at the time that they were filming this episode, Elementary, My Dear Data, they thought that Sherlock Holmes was in the public domain, and then the Arthur Conan Doyle estate said, "No, you actually need to pay us if you're going to do again."
Did they pay him in latinum?
And that's why, and that's why it took. You know, Ship in the Bottle is like season six, I think.
Yeah, it's later on.
It took them, you know, however many years that was, 4 years, to actually go back and revisit the story.
Well, and I wanted to mention, okay, sure, it's a holodeck malfunction episode, but the first two episodes of season two are just your typical, let's meet some random all-powerful... so you have the first one where, I mean, it's kind of offensive, to be honest. Like, Troy gets... impregnated by an alien and then is just fine with it.
Well, what,
like, she just decides.
What I remember most from that is that, okay, she's fine with it, and Riker is really concerned about it. He's not concerned because he's worried about Troy. He's concerned, like, okay, who did this? Which one of you guys did this? And the whole case, and even when she has the baby, I mean, Riker's back there looking through the door, like, his world has been shattered. So,
hey, I was told I could. So I was told I couldn't say anything about this episode, so I'm just going to be quiet.
You're allowed to. You're just not allowed to mention the title of the Dork Trek episode.
What? I mean, I didn't come up with the name. It's pretty self-explanatory.
But what comes out of that is this is a pretty offensive episode, and it never deals with the ramifications it pulled out. And then Where Silence Has Lease, which we haven't even talked about yet, because it's just this. Let's meet this random, probably evil alien who's just going to screw around with the Enterprise crew and make them look like really pathetic losers who can't, find their way out of a paper bag.
That story was exploring these aspects of humanity and human behavior in a way that the original series would have done. It's that basic Star Trek premise in that case. But yeah, it is just this powerful entity that they encounter, and then somehow they convince him to let them go. Yeah.
And they don't really learn anything about... They don't learn anything about the alien. They don't learn about themselves. Yeah. All they learn is that sometimes you just have to give up and hope that the alien doesn't kill you.
This is the episode where...
It's a very Fight Club kind of...
This is the episode where Picard tries to blow up the ship again, right?
Oh, sure.
But I mean, there's so many of those episodes, though. I mean, come on.
Wait, Troy's going to have a baby? Let's blow up the ship.
That's what Dork Trek calls
activate the self-destruct.
The Picard maneuver, right?
That's what we call it. There are four epic moves to the Picard. It's turn around, separate the saucer, blow up the ship, or surrender at all costs. Okay. I mean, and the funny part is when you go back and you watch it, when you think about that mentality, it's like, oh my God, he does this all the time.
You don't notice
like
so much when you're just watching, but if you go back and you actually pay attention to those, you really, because since I was listening to Dork Trek, I was paying attention to that more. And I did say, wow, Picard really does try to set the auto-destruct sequence all the time.
it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, and then, coming up on the outrageous Okana, he even jokes about it. He's like, wait, they have lasers? Well, maybe we should surrender.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't even know if he's necessarily joking. He could really be serious. <It's awesome.
laughs> It would be great if like Riker had a look like, If he had the still frame from the Dark Knight of the Joker, like, not sure of Sirius.
See, but I think that's something that they try to do to separate it from the original series, where Kirk is such a maverick and such a fighter at all costs. I mean, you could tell Kirk he's fighting the whole Klingon Empire, and he'll just kind of have that Danny Glover Predator 2 moment where he's like, "All right, who else is up?" So they make a real point to make Picard this kind of, peace-loving kind of diplomat. And they do it well. It's just to the...
Eventually they do it well. I think you're right. I would speculate at least that it was a more conscious decision of like, okay, let's make this character different than the captain we've already had. And eventually they find this kind of sweet spot where this guy does, you know, he will always work towards the peaceful solution and try to have the conversation first. But he can and will kick your ass if he needs to.
They do.
But it did take them a while to.
The turnaround for Picard, I think, is the Borg.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, the Borg episodes change him from this kind of almost like docile kind of surrender monkey to like a real deal, like ready to go captain. And that's the moment where the whole series turns around and his character takes like almost a complete 180. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that is true. But yeah, eventually they do find that sweet spot there between having the more contemplative captain and having this just maverick like Picard.
Well, and there's some moments here. I mean, when he speaks with Kirk. I really don't remember the name of the alien in Where Silence Has Lease. Is some
Nagilum, I
believe. Nagilum.
Nagilum.
Yeah. Nagilum. They're making a mulligan joke that, as you talked about on Dork Trek. He spoke with a Nagilum, and he kind of, you know, did good negotiation there, even as he was planning on blowing up the ship. He spoke with Moriarty kind of well. So you have the start of it. I want to ask you guys what you thought of, as they started doing these guest stars. You know, they sort of tried guest stars out in season one to some good effect, some bad effect. The worst episode of season one has to be the, now I'm going to forget the name of the episode that I mentioned. Too short a season.
Oh, yeah.
Where you had this guy come on to be, I don't know what their plan was, but he just did not work with the rest of the crew.
Was he the Admiral Jameson who was
getting
younger and younger?
Benjamin Button episode. Yeah, the Benjamin Button, he gets old.
So bad. So they try it again in Loud as a Whisper. But before we get there, the guy who played Moriarty, what did you think of that performance?
I love that. I love that actor. And he's popped up in other things. And I'm always like, hey, it's Moriarty. Yeah. What did he just pop up in that I just saw recently? I don't remember. But I like him. But I think he's the exception to that guest star rule that you're talking about. Like whatever the guy that played Okona or the outrageous Okona.
He was like, Billy Campbell, he was the second in line to play Will Riker in Farpoint.
I could actually see that.
Well, you can see that because he's hitting on every woman on the ship. I mean,
he
already goes after Terry Hatcher as soon as he beams aboard.
He's such like a lame version of Han Solo running around the Star Trek universe.
What he is to me is in Spaceballs. He's
Lone Star.
He's Lone Star.
Oh, is
Spaceballs.
He? He is, yes.
But
Lone Star is a lame version of Han Solo. Exactly. So I mean, it works.
And the cool part about it is, though, I mean, the guy went on to be the Rocketeer, and one of our crew members, Dennis Black and Asian. His favorite hobby, he's Black and Asian. I'm not making this up. His hobby is to find out who the guest stars are and see if they are on the upswing or the downswing of their career.
Oh,
and
that's his hobby. You said his actual hobby.
He loves to do it because, I mean, when you watch, two episodes of Next Generation a week, you have to find some kind of enjoyment in it to some extent, you know what I mean? Other than you have to watch a show you've already seen 6,000 times,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we didn't like William Campbell. Joe Piscopo, is this, and you talked about him on Dork Trek, is this somebody that an older generation than mine would know? He's a pretty famous comic, because I'd expect someone like Seinfeld.
No. Oh, no, it's...
Seinfeld wasn't even around. I mean, Seinfeld was around, but the show wasn't
it's
around.
Joe Piscopo. Joe Piscopo was on SNL forever. Yeah, Joe Piscopo. Yeah. Joe, he did...
Once upon a time, Joe Piscopo was somebody that people knew.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Not anymore,
was
but a long
funny?
Time ago.
The thing is, I mean...
Was he funny in this
no.
episode?
No.
He was supposed to be funny.
Yeah, but
I'm
he's
not
from
sure
the,
he was.
He's from the bad period of Saturday Night Live that nobody likes.
That's not necessarily...
Or one of the bad
But I mean, for when SNL was big, when he was big, it was Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo. Those were the two big guys on the show then. So,
okay.
I mean, he was a superstar. He did the Frank Sinatra Stevie Wonder bit with the, Ebony and Ivory. If you guys are you familiar with this at all?
No,
I remember.
Wow, I feel really.
I only very vaguely remember Saturday Night Live that old.
I feel really old right now.
I remember more the John Lovitz era is more. Yeah.
Well, he was on from 1980 to 1984. So this would have been obviously before my time. And even these aren't the episodes they show in syndication. You know, when they show older episodes, it's stuff where Steve Martin would have been there or maybe Martin Short. But this era, I think, is sort of the lost years from SNL. Mm.
The Eddie Murphy, Joe Piscopo years do not get shown that often.
But generally speaking, Joe Piscopo, at the time that this episode here was made, I mean, Joe Piscopo was a big name. It would have been like when Voyager was on, it would have been like if Jerry Seinfeld had come on Voyager. It's somebody who everybody knows. Okay. And right. And I think that in this episode, I mean, of course, the jokes are not funny to us now, but I think that was part of the point in this episode, too, and Data trying to find out what is funny and what's not. And they kind of parodied that with this kind of cornball stand-up routine.
Guinan tells this horrible joke, like, you're a droid and I'm annoyed. I'm annoyed. Yeah. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
And Data says, I'm not laughing. On that one. You told a joke. Right. Yeah. I'm not laughing.
I remember being confused by that because, you know, the point is Data, you're confused why Data isn't laughing, but I was always confused as to how that even qualified as a joke.
Yes.
Let alone a funny one.
That
whole scene was just very, very confusing.
If you have to explain a joke to an android, it's not good.
If you have to explain a joke to the audience,
exactly.
It's not good.
And that's why you should never just flat out tell a joke like that in a script, in a TV show, or a movie.
Right.
What you should always do is have what's called the orphan punchline, where you cut into the scene and they're at the very end of telling a long joke, and you only hear like the last line of it.
That's the Ferengi and the gorilla.
And so you have.
Exactly.
So you have no idea what the joke was, and you can have your characters react however you need them to react, and you don't have to worry about making the joke actually funny for the audience, because that doesn't matter. Do Ferengi in the gorilla suit has to go, and fine. that's way more funnier than whatever that joke actually is, I guarantee it.
And I think what the producers missed was Brent Spiner is really, really funny. And kind of everything he did in the episode was hilarious. So I'm sitting here, I'm not laughing at Guinan. I'm not laughing at Joe Piscopo. I'm certainly not laughing at the outrageous Okana. But I am laughing at every single thing that Brent Spiner does as Data.
Yeah.
And I think he's
the ultimate straight man.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the case in that episode, though, that I'm not so sure it was actually supposed to be funny in the first place. It was some of the early development of Data, you know, exploring what it means to be human. And of course, he doesn't get it. And he shouldn't get it that early on. If he actually understood what it's like to be human at the beginning of season two, then where are they going to go?
That's half your episodes right there.
Yeah. That's right.
Right.
See, the way...
Okay, so...
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Don. Go ahead,
I was
Bob.
Just going to say, the way I looked at the outrageous Ono, or whatever the heck his name is it's... These two stories are okay. If Data is looking to understand, you know, the idea of humor, and you have some Han Solo with a ponytail running around with some other giant story taking place, then I think it's okay. But for this to be your whole episode, I mean, you're really losing me. I mean, this is it. This is the best effort you have at this point. So this episode was kind of a real bummer.
Well, and even at the end, Picard looks kind of like, did we just do all of this for our episode? You know, when the kids who love each other from the warring, you know, faction, warring worlds are getting together at the end, and Okana is, you know, saying, oh, you know, I've shuttled you back and forth all this, and they cut over to Picard, and then Troy makes her statement of, now we're hearing some truth come out. It's like, that's, you know,
so
her
annoying
statement of obvious
Captain
for the episode,
but, of the flagship. Yeah, of the Federation.
Picard, he looks like he's himself is annoyed that they're at the end of their episode. And
oh, yeah, totally.
This is all that's happened.
Because he's thinking...
He's got this look of like, is this really all we're doing this
right
week? Nothing else? No Romulans, no Klingons?
I'm the captain of the starship, the flagship for Match.com. What is going on here, you know? Just goofy.
Exactly.
But there was an episode similar to this in the first series with, I can't remember the premise of the episode because it enraged me so much, was, I guess there were Romulans in the neutral zone. There were two Romulan...
Angel One.
Yes!
Angel One.
And you've got this big crisis going on, you know, thousands of light years away, but then you've got your flagship dealing with, you know, some kid that fell in some flowers or so, whatever it was. And
yes.
It was so preposterous.
Oh, that's
and it
justice
just aggravates you because
when
you know
Wesley
there's
jumped
justice
into the flower
was
bed.
Angel One was an even worse thing they were dealing
Angel
with.
Angel One is
Romulans
Riker
like,
with the open
right
shirt all the time.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah, with the Lady Planet. See, I know lady it as planet, the Lady Planet. But I mean, the thing is, you have all these exciting things going on in outer space, right. And this is the crew we choose to follow around sometimes.
Yeah.
And it stinks when you get that feeling when you watch Star Trek: The Next Generation. You know, mm-hmm. when you have an episode that's just like, oh my god, really?
Yeah, which happened yeah. more during exactly. season one and two, and then things started yeah. turning around more.
Yeah, and I think eventually they get to a place where I really think in like season seven, especially, they get really good at just being able to do things like that in a better way, being able to like, okay, here's just kind of like a slice of life of these people on this day on this ship.
Yeah.
And keeping it interesting and keeping it still so it still feels kind of real from a human standpoint. But early on, you're right, when they try to do that, it just yeah. does not work in any way, shape, or yeah. form.
Well, and while we're talking about guest stars, we can go on to the next one, probably the last one I've seen because I'm trying to keep up with Dork Trek as it's released.
Oh, why, thank you.
So loud, yeah. So Loud as a Whisper, which I kind of think is a failure on all fronts. It's kind of a remake of Too Short a Season, only this time instead of him being old and aging backwards, he's deaf and then loses his chorus. Does anyone have any positive things to say about this episode before I continue?
I think Dr. Salar is pretty hot.
Okay,
other than that,
right.
I'm not sure what else there
I don't
is
think
to say.
Is Dr. Salar in that episode?
No.
She is. That's her first appearance.
She's in the Schizoid Man, actually.
Right?
She's in the next episode.
Yeah. She's in the Schizoid Man. So your yeah. favorite part of the episode isn't even in that episode.
Isn't even in this episode.
I have the wrong episode.
That's how much of an impression this episode made on Brian. That his memories of this episode are from the next episode.
From a different episode.
Well, the one female member of the chorus was kind of hot in a, like, you know, late 80s sort of big hair.
Wait,
way.
You mean late 1980s or late 80s? What do you mean there?
The late 1980s, okay. where you sort of have really stupid looking curly hair.
Okay.
That doesn't make you actually
look
better.
Marina Sirtis when she went on the Arsenio Hall show.
Yes.
Exactly. Right. Oh my goodness. But yeah, this episode is so weird because, I mean, okay, so the guest star they got was an actor who is deaf, and he sort of petitioned Roddenberry to do a show about deaf people. But this is what they did with
it. Yeah.
Like, it really portrays him as this terrible person
yeah.
who can't do anything without his
yeah.
chorus, and he sort of gets right. them killed. I really feel like they were struggling at this point to
yeah.
figure out stories. And even when they had a story idea in front of them, they didn't know what
to do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing a story about a deaf character, of course. It's just
sure.
kind of how do you do it? Like later, I know in Deep Space Nine, they had an episode, I think, called Melora, where they have a handicapped character who she's, I think, confined to a wheelchair, but she still goes about her normal duties as a Starfleet officer. And I think she may have even appeared on The Next Generation once, I forget, but in this case, yeah,
no,
she did not. Okay, it's only Deep Space Nine, but they,
no.
Bring this. They always go back to this plot line of diplomatic mission. It's always a diplomatic mission, right? And then,
yeah.
and then, Bob, tell us. I mean, what you guys were talking about on Dork Trek about here is that in the 24th century, when they have cures for so many diseases, but yet here's someone who can't speak, and they're unable to give him any other way of speaking.
Yeah.
The funny part about it is they approach it as this is the race of his people, and this is what happens from, I guess, constant inbreeding is none of them can hear. So if anything, this episode is
wow.
yeah, I mean, that's the way they approach it, because they mention like the so-and-sos back in England and the so-and-so race that are born without limbs. It's like,
they
you know,
that, yeah.
and it just all this episode says to me is you shouldn't inbreed. Like, that's all it says. That's the message of this episode. But the thing about this episode, and I think the season opener, which is the baby, is I think Star Trek: The Next Generation kind of gets into this need to be preachy to some extent, and
yeah,
the original
yeah.
series did it, and it does it so well. And I don't think Next Generation is as good because they're tackling things like the deaf and like abortion and things of that nature, and it's just like these things don't
yeah.
need to be talked about in a Star Trek universe, and if they're going to be talked about, they should be kind of approached, I guess, a little more professionally or a little better.
Well, that's the thing. I think
we were just generally better at being preachy in the 60s than we were in the 80s.
But
that's
I think we were just generally bad at being preachy in the 80s.
I think another thing, though, is that a difference between the Next Generation and the original series in this is that the original series stories were written by great science fiction authors, you know, great masters of SF, mm-hmm. versus a lot of the Next Generation stuff, which was written more by the writing staff of the show. You know, you didn't have these famous authors behind a lot of this stuff. And I think that those people, because they are literary science fiction writers who don't have the benefit of all the visuals normally, are better able to articulate those ideas through the story.
I agree with that.
That's a really good point. I mean, the writer of Loud as a Whisper, I'm looking her up on Memory Alpha. Yeah, cheating. Thanks, Bob. But no, she wasn't like a famous SF writer. She was simply someone who had done other TV and got hired on. And she did a fine job. It's not a horrible episode. But as far as we're talking about Star Trek and this being an important episode for the deaf community, I think it really fails. Yeah. Like, it doesn't portray him in a good way. It doesn't show any benefits he has from being deaf. It just shows him as being really arrogant and useless when he doesn't have his
course. Yeah, and I think that's the exact opposite message that, you know, they needed to portray when it comes to deaf people, was like, hey, just because they're differently able doesn't mean they're kind of useless. But without three people dressed in white, this guy's got no shot at communicating with anybody. So it's a silly premise, but I think
can't even read or
write. Yeah, and I think And I think a lot of the problem with season two is, you know, there was a writer strike in 1988 when the season, you know, when the whole thing kicked off. And I think, you know, I guess you can say what happened to Star Trek The Next Generation season two and Heroes season two are similar in vain, that they're just kind of, it's kind of a ship without a rudder at this point, and they're lucky they made it through, and you know, and you can just kind of look forward to the episodes ahead.
Yeah, and Greg also blames that writer strike in 88 for the low quality of Star Trek V.
Yeah, I mean,
Star Trek V, 2009 Star Trek. Lots of things with the faults of writer strikes and not any of the people involved.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, if you don't have your best,
I would agree with that.
People, you know, doing the best kind of work they can do, and you just need to pound out scripts because the studio is saying, well, hey, just because there's a writer strike, we need episodes. Then, you know, you're kind of you've painted yourself into a corner. And you got to get something done.
Yeah,
you know. So
yeah, but the other thing while we're on this episode too is that you look what The Next Generation was doing with Geordi. And saying about blind people, that here's a character that he's blind, but he's the chief engineer of the ship. He can do whatever needs to be done. And then yet here, when they deal with deafness, they are unable to kind of carry that really that idea it. Over.
Yeah, they walk maybe, straight into the wall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe it was LeVar Burton. Obviously, he's a great actor, a great activist. And it's possible that he was sort of leading the charge in what they did with Geordi, and maybe this actor they brought on didn't have much control over the script. I mean,
well,
he did get it
changed.
It's
one episode, so.
Yeah, he suggested the ending.
He suggested the ending.
I think it's more a matter of if the point of that you're trying to convey is, hey, just because somebody has a disability doesn't mean they're useless or they're worthless, and they can, you know, they still have the means to contribute and interact with you. It's like, the way to get that point across is with a character like Geordi, who's okay, so he has his disability, but he has his way that he works around it, and then he just has his life that he lives, and so we have stories and he's in those stories, but his stories are never really about his disability.
Yeah, whereas more like the way Marlene Matlin was brought onto West Wing.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Sure, she's deaf. She's got a translator there, but it doesn't have any effect really in her ability to do what she does.
And I look
But then on the other side of that coin is when you build a whole episode around this person, they have this disability, and everything about the episode is going to relate back to them, relate back to that disability. And it's like, well, it's still a TV show. It still needs drama and conflict and tension and rising action and all of that. So it's like, well, if you're focusing all of everything about this episode towards this disability, then it's going to naturally come down to the fact that their disability inhibits them. It's like, well, that's not going to create the message that you ultimately want to give.
It's exactly what you're not supposed to do. You know, I'm not supposed to meet someone who's different from me and have my whole conversation be about like this difference
how
that I
different.
Don't understand.
Yeah, but at the same time,
I'm supposed to
at the same time too. It's got to be 45 minutes worth of fun, and you got to exactly. and you have to introduce this character. They have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end in 45 minutes while normally telling another story about somebody else on the crew. So I mean, you figure they probably have 26, 27 minutes of total screen time, and you got to knock this thing out. So. You know, you really can't play around with it. Whereas Geordi, you have, you know, endless amounts of opportunities to kind of discuss his condition and yada, yada, yada. Yeah, so it's just one of those things.
So why don't we kind of move ahead a little bit here just to kind of wrap up where season two led us? Because, okay, we talked about a writer's strike, generally the quality of the scripts. And I guess also we're being kind of harsh on season two. And I think one reason for that is because we do know that The Next Generation becomes a great show. I think it was 1994 in the final season when The Next Generation was actually nominated for an Emmy for Best Drama. So that was kind of an unprecedented thing for a science fiction series. And X-Files was nominated in that same year as well. So when we look back at the early seasons, we kind of see how unsure they were of what they were doing and how difficult it was to get going to lead up to what we know comes later. But as you look through season two, what are the highlights in season two? I mean, if we go a couple of more episodes from here, we do have The Measure of a Man, which I think is one
episode.
Of the very good Star Trek Next Generation episodes.
That's a great episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I think that's probably the first point where Next Generation finds its own footing in terms of having an episode be about something, but still be good on its own on its own merits.
Yeah. And then I mean we've got Q Who finally picking up that thread from the end of season one.
Emissary
was even really good. Pen Pals, sure.
The Dolphin is a great episode.
It's another one of those moments where we see the childlike Data, right? It's one of the early moments of his development.
I look at season two as, and you can take it as like, oh, there's some really bad moments, but there, and we mentioned this in the first episode of season two for Door Trek, was they put in these really dynamic and kind of interesting features that remain throughout the series, which is Guinan and 10-4, and even to some extent, I mean, I think for me at least, and I know I might get, you know, tarred and feathered for this, but a big plus for season two for me is Pulaski. I really enjoy her, and the funny part is,
I think you might be the first person I've ever met that has liked.
I think we just lost
character.
Bob here, guys. I'm sorry.
No,
I just
you know,
I think I just disconnected Bob.
And you know, and I hate to say it, but I mean, she brings that kind of necessary conflict to some extent, like because in season one, it's such like a happy-go-lucky crew. Everybody's there. Everybody's having a good time. Everybody likes each other, and you have this kind of, as I said earlier, like a fly in the ointment. She's brand new to this vessel, and she has no idea what's going on. And it's to some extent, it's kind of like a fresh take on it, because if you're walking around, this is the easiest way I'll describe it. If you're walking around your work, okay, and you're just having a good time no matter where you work, and all of a sudden you see a robot come up next to you, you'd be like, what the heck is this thing? And everybody else is just like, oh, it's a robot. And you're like, dude, that's just weird. You know what I mean? And she has kind of like almost a realistic view of this whole thing. And I find it refreshing and kind of enjoyable. And I know, again, I may be one of the only people that say it, but she brings something different to the table, which is nice. There's conflict there. And in the first, and I mean, and everybody knows the Roddenberry rule for Star Trek is there's no real inner conflict between characters. And for her to be, and for her to be there being crotchety and kind of mean to Data and stuff, especially to Data, because everybody loves Data. I like her.
That was the Next Gen spinoff. Everybody,
yeah, totally.
It was a comedy, right?
But no,
yeah, I mean, I know. In theory, I agree with you. Actually, I mean, I know I've talked on earlier podcasts that, you know, just because it's a utopia, just because, you know, everybody is fed and has a roof over their heads, and it's a utopia in that sense, I don't think necessarily means that you follow to the Roddenberry utopia where everybody gets along all the time. And so it's like, okay, if, you know, even in the perfect future where everything is figured out, does that necessarily mean you're going to get along with everybody you work with? No, not necessarily. Does it mean that the person that you sit next to all day long isn't kind of a jerk about some things? No, not necessarily. So in principle, I agree. It's just, she's just so goddamn annoying.
But I mean,
I liked her in The Child, at like where Picard is sort of coming after her. Like, why isn't she reporting to the bridge? And she's there talking to Troy. And it's like, seriously, Jean-Luc, there's some like really important stuff going on here with Troy. And I don't care about your protocol. And then, okay, Elementary Dear Data, where, yeah, sure, she is challenging Data. She's like, okay, if he is this sentient being that you claim he is, can he do things that sentient beings can do? And that, yeah, sure, she is challenging him on a level that he's not been challenged. And that what I do need to see from her is a growing respect for Data, a growing respect for the rest of the crew, and not to just be crotchety.
I can see that. But as you know, you said, try to find positive things about season two. And I mean, I find it refreshing. And I mean, you also got to give...
God bless you for trying,
sir. But it's something that I enjoy. And you also have to give props to... this is the introduction of O'Brien, where he actually gets a name and a very beloved Star Trek character in the later seasons and the later series becomes, you know, as opposed to being, you know, Transporter Chief, he's got a real name. And he even kind of comes up with cool ideas, I guess, in the last episode we watched, which was Unnatural Selection. Like, it was his idea to kind of come up with the, you know, the filter to, you know, bring Pulaski back and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, in season one, everybody knows that would have been Wesley.
Yeah, that would have been.
Wesley would have been like, hey, I got an idea, durr. You know what I mean? So it was nice.
Somebody please just listen to me. Shut up, Wesley.
Someone love me. So, you know, it's not.
Shut up, Wesley.
Shut up, Wesley.
There you go. Yeah. Pulaski has just always rubbed me the wrong way. I definitely see what you're saying in terms of her coming in at the beginning and her reaction to having a robot around her, an android around her.
A robot.
Yeah. Robot.
So,
I wish she hadn't been brought in to replace Beverly. Well, obviously, Gates McFadden had her reasons to leave the show at this time. But I wish that Beverly had been around and we were able to have a character come in to, yes, give us that outsider's view without it having to be a new doctor, you know?
And I mean, and it sucks too because Beverly and Picard have such an interesting dynamic that you lose that for a season. But they do a great job in the later episodes of just kind of picking that right back up to the point where, you know, you learn, I think it's in like season 4 or 5 that Picard and Crusher have breakfast every day together. Yeah. And it's like, that's a cool thing. So, great. You know, it's addition, you know, it's addition and subtraction. You know, there's positives and negatives to her leaving. But, you know, just for something kind of different, just for a little bit of a different taste. It's kind of like you can't eat steak all the time. Every now and then you have to have a slice of pizza. And I just look at Pulaski as like a slice of pizza in your Star Trek journey.
Every now and then you need that can of spam that is Dr.
Exactly,
Pulaski.
You know what I mean?
We also, I think, forget that Beverly of the later seasons that we know is different than the Beverly of the first season. You know, the character became a much more interesting and more likable character part of the crew.
Early on, she's very much just Wesley's mom.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it takes her a while to become a character in her own.
So maybe her leaving the show for a season and coming back was overall a good thing for the show itself and for the cast and the crew.
And Guinan. I mean, Guinan's solid, you know? Guinan's
excellent. Oh, Guinan's great. Yeah.
So, and I mean, that's a...
Through generations, she was...
Yeah, there's so many moments all through.
Without her, generations would not have, for me, the emotional impact that it really
had. Oh, absolutely not.
I think, too, even here in the second season, in Q-Who, when Picard goes to talk to Guinan about the Borg, I mean, the information that she can convey, the conversation that they have, gave so much more weight to that Borg threat to make it a little bit less faceless of just, oh, here's this big bad cube in space that's going to chase us.
Yeah.
And then they were able to carry that through the whole series as well.
She's able to give us a facet of the Borg that makes them something more than just this alien of the week or that alien of the week.
See, and the great part, it's
her scene and the information that she imparts, where it's like, okay, this is not just the Tyrellians and their plague or whatever it is. This is something different, and this feels like a bigger deal.
See, and I think another positive thing about her is, you know, Whoopi Goldberg, you may not agree with her politically, you may not like her all that much, but at the end of the day, I mean, she is a talented person, and you can see that in in almost all of her scenes. Her intro scene, when her, when Wesley's sitting there longing, looking out the window, and in the child episode, and he's just staring out into space blankly, and Guinan walks over and they have this nice conversation. I mean, that's a great scene. And I think every scene she's in, to some extent, are well done scenes, because it's written well, and even if it's not written all that well, it's acted well, and that's a nice addition. Because if you think about it, I mean Picard is Shakespeare and trained actor, and he's brilliant, but I mean, he doesn't really get a chance to kind of show his chops, where she can kind of come in little by little and you know, just kind of steal an episode here and steal a scene there. So it's a real positive addition to the show.
Most definitely.
Yeah,
well, I guess this episode here, as we wrap up, Q-Who, it comes late in the season. There are 6 more episodes in the season after Q-Who. And Q-Who really feels to me often like, it's not exactly the turning point, but because it introduced the Borg, it introduced some more serious elements, and like we just talked about with Guinan, that lead us into season 3, which of course, season 3 ends with the best of both worlds, which is... Mm-hmm. Where they finally fully grow the beard. Yeah. You know, up to this point, Riker is growing in the beard, but he hasn't actually grown the beard yet. So, so I guess final thoughts on season 2. How about you, Brian?
You know, looking at this episode list, for a while I've been defending season 2 as not as bad as everybody remembers it. But looking at this episode list, there are fewer bright spots than I remember. Don't get me wrong, there are bright spots. I like Elementary Dear Data. Measure of Man, I think, is great. I don't mind Where Silence Is Least. It is kind of part of the stock. Big, powerful energy being does what he pleases. But it's getting there. You can just feel it, like, you know, the wheels are spinning in season 1, and in season 2, they're just starting to catch every now and then and just gain a little bit of traction. And... Mm-hmm. You know, and unfortunately, it just kind of ends on such a terrible... I mean, I know we've trashed Shades of Grey before, so we don't need to get into it
now. I never
pass
up a chance to make a Shades of Grey joke. Everybody knows that.
Oh, my God. But again,
what George Trek is going to do with that.
Again, we should give credit or lack of credit where lack of credit is due, and say that there is this writer's strike, and that is, you know, why Shades of Grey exists. But... It feels like it's getting there, and fortunately, Next Generation was not being made today, and somebody at the network went, well, you know, your numbers aren't great for the first 2 seasons, but here's another season to figure it out. This point has been made before, but were Next Generation being produced today
by the Sci-Fi Channel,
and you had the same season 1, we would never have gotten past, you know, episode 9. It just never would have happened.
True.
Yeah, for me, season 2 is sort of like with the Clone Wars, the new Star Wars animated show that's on now. Season 1 was iffy, but you sort of give it a pass because it's season 1. At this point, it's like season 4. They know what they're doing. They can make a good episode. And they're still sometimes just doing Gungan episodes where it's just Jar Jar trying to save the day.
How do you watch that?
And it's just, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know how to make a good show. You've done it a few times. Why are you still making Where Silence Has Least? You know, why are you still making The Child? You don't have to. And it wasn't kind of until season 3 and then 4 where they realized they had the ability to make a good episode week after week. Season 2 is kind of where they had the ability, they had the money, they were set up. But something was holding them back. And writer's strike, the writing staff was still young, but they were being held back from what they really could do.
How about you, Bob?
I agree with both of the gentlemen before me. I think it's a car that's in first gear. And you eventually you have to learn how to drive stick, or you're just going to keep stalling out. And, you know, I think they figured it out well. And you just kind of, and the funny part is, you know, as a podcast, we're sitting here and we're watching each episode. And the funny part is, I watched the entire series about a year ago after my daughter was born. I sat down and I watched every episode of TNG. And I don't remember a lot of these episodes. And I think that and that's the easiest way to describe it. It's like some of them are just forgettable. It's like, okay, it's a show.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I said, it's a nice way to kill 45 minutes, but at least and like you said, sometimes it's like they take two steps forward, then they take three steps backwards, and there's not a lot of consistency, but then later on you just think like, oh, well, this is where it's going to go and it's going to be a brilliant run, but it's just baby steps.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there are a few moments in here they do some things to try to develop some characters. You know, we have A Matter of Honor, we have a Worf episode. I think The Measure of a Man was great. I have one of my, for some odd reason, an episode that I really like from season two is The Royale, just because it's so cheesy. That
what's The Royale?
They find this doorway on a planet and there's nothing else there, and they go inside and they have to win enough money in the casino to buy the hotel casino so they can go back outside.
Okay, it reminds me of, I have a similar feeling about the episode with the dolphin. Do you remember the dolphin?
Yeah.
With a shapeshifter bodyguard.
And Wesley falls in love with this girl and he's all amped on her, and then she turns out to be this hairy beast and he's like, no, I'm good. that episode, and it's just so hilarious to me because it's like, hey, look, Wesley's he's shallow just like the rest of us. You know what I mean? But again, it's there are moments. There are nice potential moments, and you can see, as Greg said before, it's like then they kind of put everything together and they, okay, we can do this on a weekly basis, and we're gonna blow the doors off of people. Yeah. But I mean, you know, you get the Borg in this. Worf plays a bigger part in this series, starting in season two. So there are positives. It's just they're hard to find.
Yeah. All right.
Exactly.
Well, that's our take on season two, anyway. And I still encourage everybody to watch season two. You know, watch the whole series in order. You can appreciate more what happens in season three and four and onwards when you know where they've been and you see season two. So I'm sure probably anyone listening to this has already seen all these episodes before, but maybe it's been many years. So it is fun to go back and watch them. And if you go back and watch them and tune into Dork Trek, and Bob and his crew will take you through them all and gives you a new perspective, I would say.
Yes.
On episodes like The Baby.
Please, if you do listen to Dork Trek, if you go to dorktrek.com, if you search us out on iTunes and you download the show, please just go into this kind of realizing that we're a comedy podcast.
Yes.
like we're not going to discuss we're, you know, the deeper meanings in religion. We're going to make a lot of fart jokes, and there might be a few things that are a tinge off color, but that's just what we do, and we have fun doing it. And again, it's meant no disrespect. I had a kid at Chicago Con, he was basically yelling in my face because I told him, he's like, so what is the podcast? And I was like, oh, we watch Star Trek and kind of poke fun at it. He's like, don't ever make fun of Star Trek. And he threw the card back in my face.
Oh, really?
I said, dude, I'm wearing a uniform. It's like, what are you doing to me? You know? So it's done kind of tongue in cheek. We have fun with it. But I mean, you know, hey, watch season one and two. It kind of deserves to be made fun of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is fun, and it's a fun podcast as well. And it's fine to make fun of Star Trek from time to time. I mean, that's...
It is.
It's the difference. I forget whose bit this is. Maybe it's a Patton Oswalt bit. I'm not sure. But somebody describing the difference between the way Republicans love their country or conservatives love their country and Democrats or liberals feel about the country is there's the kind of the childlike love where mommy is perfect and mommy can do no wrong. And then there's the grown-up style love, which is like, no, I know this is ridiculous. I know there are parts of it that is not very appealing, but I love it anyway, despite those and you know, because of it in a tongue-in-cheek way. And I also love the really awesome parts. It's like the ability to love something while acknowledging that, you know, this part of it is not so great and it's not perfect. And we can have fun with the parts that aren't.
Oh,
so
totally!
Great.
It's like, but, picking on your picking on your little brother. You love your little brother, but you're gonna pick on him, you know.
Yeah, it's the child, you know, love of no, it's Star Trek. You can't make fun of it because that's just, you don't do that. It's, you know, it's perfect. Yeah, it's like, no. I mean, be a grown up about it and go, No, season two. You
look at it with a grown-up perspective and go, hey, look, an alien impregnated a woman unwillingly. That's wrong on many levels.
Right.
All right. Well, so that's where you can find Dork Trek at dorktrek.com, right?
Yes.
And in iTunes as well. And I think you're on Stitcher as well, right?
We are on Stitcher as well. Yes, yep. That's correct.
All right. And Brian, tell everybody where they can find you around the interwebs.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Brian Finifter, BrianFinifter. I know it's a terribly complicated name. And I'm also a regular on a podcast called Down in Front, where we sit down and we watch movies and we record our own commentaries to them, and we have a lot of fun. We just did Iron Man 2 today and the Neutron movie.
Oh, nice.
Earlier today.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear both of those.
That's awesome.
So we've been doing it for several years now, a few years.
That's very cool.
And you can find us at downinfront.net. We do live shows every week whenever we record, which you can find at downinfront.net/live. We also have a really awesome forum of really awesome listeners and contributors that have really fantastic discussions at downinfront.net/forums. And you can check us out there.
All right. Sounds great. And Bob, let's also remind people to find you on Twitter.
Yes, we're on Twitter.
Dork Trek.
I have so many Twitter accounts. I'm on Twitter at just Bob. It's at B France, FRANTZ19. I'm also for at Dork Trek. I'm also at Bob's Boneyard. I'm also at 41 Comic. I am all over. It's preposterous how many Twitter accounts I have. I really need to get out more. But again, before I leave, I would like to thank the fine gentleman from the Ready Room for having us on. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you coming on, Bob. Well, thanks a lot, guys, and we'll do this again soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Well, yeah, Chris, that was a fantastic feature we had. Obviously, we've had Brian on the show many times before. It was great to have that new voice of Bob Fresh / AKA Bob France. I still don't know which one is his real name and which is his DJ name, but either way, glad to have him on the show.
Yeah, it was great. It's, you know, I'm a big fan of the Dork Trek podcast, and it was really wonderful to have Bob on with us for discussion. Of course, it's always great to have Brian on and all the great insights that he brings to the discussions that we have about the good and the bad of Star Trek, and especially the Next Generation. So, Greg, did you realize that we just hit an interesting milestone here with this episode of The Ready Room? This is show number 21, and you know what that means.
Oh, fantastic. Our podcast can finally drink.
That's right. Of course, over here where I am, we were able to drink from the last show of episode 20, but now, whether we're in Japan or in the States, we can both drink.
That's fantastic. And we've been doing the show at this point, you know, we're coming up on, I believe, was it 6 or 7 months as well? We've been doing this since May.
Yeah, about 6 months now, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been great.
So that's fantastic. I'm glad we've been able to do the show pretty regularly, and we're starting to build up that group of listeners that listen to us week to week. It's really exciting, and it makes me love doing this show every week.
Yeah, we do have a great group of listeners, and they interact with us on Twitter, where you can definitely find us anytime ready to talk Trek under username TrekFM. And also, some of our listeners have been making their way over to Facebook to talk to us there as well, and that's at facebook.com/TrekFM. And Greg, if anyone wants to talk to you directly on Twitter, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find me at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN.
All right. And I'm there too, as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And also, while you're hanging around our site, there are quite a few games for you to play these days. We have crosswords, word searches, and we even have Trek Trivia on there. You can go to trek.fm/trektrivia to play the multiple choice quizzes. And under the games menu, you'll also find links to the crosswords and the word searches. And if you want even more trivia, be sure to follow username TrekTrivia on Twitter, where Anthony Davis and Mark Stamper do live quizzes several times a week. And also, Greg, I almost forgot to tell people how to just contact us directly through our website. If you go to trek.fm/contact, you'll find a form there where you can send us a note. And you can also leave us a voicemail if you prefer. Just call 646-652-TREK and let us know what you think about anything that we talked about today or on any other show. Well, Greg, as I'm still trying to shake this cold, I think Dr. Pulaski wants me to come down for another shot, so I'm going to head on out.
All right, Chris. Yeah, I think it's time to stick a holographic drawing of the USS Enterprise in it, because the ready room is done.